Hey, guys. Welcome to the show. How are you doing? Good, good. I think today's Friday, right? So that's good. Well, for most of us, some people got to work on the weekend. Well, of course, they don't work all weekend too, just not on this show. That's all. But yeah, it's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. I don't know. Basically, I'm against all the things that my government does. The government does. It's not really mine. It's debatable whether I'm its. But anyway. Yeah, no, I'm against it. And I like trying to explain why you should be against it, too. Basically, that's the show. I interview reporters and journalists and columnists, and I ask them things, and they say stuff. That's basically what it is. So if you're new around here, now you've been to orientation. Libertarian foreign policy. ScottHorton.org is my website. I keep all my interview archives and my whole show archives and all my article archives and all my archive archives and all my archives. They're at ScottHorton.org. More than 3,800 interviews now going back to 2003. Proving how good myself and all of my guests are on everything. Back when the stuff was going on. Not just Monday morning quarterback style. And you follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Hey, you should consider that. Maybe I should follow him on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. You might regret it. But, yeah, it'd probably be all right. Okay. Today on the show, I'll be talking with Rupert Stone. I think I've been following him on Twitter for a little while now. He's written a thing in Newsweek called Beyond Torture. Hey, this is the best thing written in Newsweek about torture in a long, long time, I think. Very important story here. Get us up to date on American torture. It's funny, you know, if John McCain was the president right now, there would be less torture than under Barack Obama. Now, granted, mostly that's because we would all be dead in a thermonuclear war with Russia back in 2009 or 10 at the latest, probably, right? So that's the main reason there wouldn't be torture. But the secondary reason to that is somebody actually tortured McCain before, although actually that's debatable whether they ever really abused him at all. Some of the people locked up with McCain have disputed just how rough he had it. But anyway, boy, he had to listen to a guy being tortured one time, and it really bothered him. And so, and of course, what does it take to get a conservative Republican to oppose torture, right? You gotta torture him. That's the only way. Otherwise, they're simply barbarians. Right? As long as the political party they've subscribed to demands it of them. They're barbarians, not civilized men at all. But if you torture one, then he'll become an anti-torture guy. And so McCain now has a new anti-torture law. Well, why do we need a new anti-torture law? Good question. I thought we already had anti-torture laws. Yeah, but that didn't stop them before. But I thought Obama signed an executive order banning torture. Yeah, only kinda. You want Hillary to repeal it? Or Jeb? It's gonna be Jeb. So John McCain wants to pass a law. The old kook is good for one thing only. It's him and Feinstein that are doing it. And she's only good for one thing too, right? That's the only thing she's good on in her whole life, ever. Torture. And I ain't saying she's perfect on it. I don't think she's done nearly enough. But, eh. For a Dianne Feinstein, that's pretty damn good. It's the only redeeming quality of her entire existence. As far as I'm aware, I don't know. Maybe she tips her cab drivers well or something. Not that I've ever heard an anecdote like that. I'm just saying it's within the realm of possibility. She's got other redeeming qualities. I'm just saying, as far as I know, it's her only one. That's a pretty good one. You know, it's important to have anti-torture senators, don't you think? I mean, if you have to have a Senate. Don't mean to just take that for granted, because I don't think you do, but anyway. All right. Now hear this. Would you? Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation to the... Hey. What is with this thing? Jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support the Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verde Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Periscal, Costa Rica, and he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day, is covered. You can learn and practice some skills, or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. scotthorton.org/raffle. Isn't that great? Listener to this show, figured I know how I can help support the show. I'll raffle off tickets to a week's vacation in your own private house. 3 meals a day. A beautiful river. Funny birds you've never seen before. Probably monkeys and crazy things. I don't know. I've never been to Costa Rica, but don't you want to go to Costa Rica? You're not willing to pay 50 chance. I'm not good at talking. Sorry. I know I'm a radio show host. I'm supposed to know how to talk good, but I ain't, can't. Yeah, no, $50 for a very good chance. I don't know if I can break down the probabilities for you, because I'm not really good at statistics and stuff, but I would say that if you were to buy a raffle ticket to win a chance, to win at your chance of a vacation there, that, you got pretty damn good odds. A hell of a lot better than winning the lottery. Although I know a lottery isn't $50. But still. You probably blow $50 on lottery tickets sometimes, right? Or over the course of not very long. Definitely worth it. And you know what? Face it. You've been meaning to send $50 to help support the show anyway. You know? I got a buzz in the background here, man. I gotta switch out. This old microphone, man. It's so goddamn old. When I'm quiet, the lowest it goes is to negative 63. That's probably these cables, too. And it just ain't quiet enough. So, the solution is you should buy a lottery ticket. A raffle ticket to win a vacation to Costa Rica. The drawing's going to be in, I don't know, say right about a month. That way you'll still have time to go and it'll still be summertime. Airfare's on you, but you get a week's stay, 3 meals a day. I know it's a good deal because the people who bought the tickets already have sent me emails saying how excited they are. They can't wait to win this thing. So, get in on it while the getting is good. I need to do more to promote it too. But anyway, there you go. So you want to support the show and you want to win a vacation to Costa Rica? Go to scotthorton.org/raffle. scotthorton.org/raffle. And win a vacation to Costa Rica. All right, cool. All right, I've wasted enough time for this segment. That's all right, because it's over now. But coming up here in a minute, I got a, well, it's the same old thing, man. I'm going to be talking about high treason. It's the kind of thing that, it's so crazy, it sounds like maybe it's not true. But no, it's really true. It's right here in the Wall Street Journal today. America backing Al-Qaeda in Syria, still, again, for 4 years straight now, but even more, and admitting it, bragging about it. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm just discrediting the Empire best I can. All I got to do is tell the truth about them, so they make my job pretty easy. Yes, it does get a little repetitive. But anyway. Man, you know what? I want to mention this real quick in case I just don't have the time later, and I guess I will. But I swear I'm going to get right to... What the hell am I going to do here? Nah, I'll save this till later. Do you see Foxman bashes Israel? Go look at that during the commercial at Mondo Weiss. Maybe I'll get back to that later. Oh, no, I got to talk about this. The Wall Street Journal today. It's crazy. It is. It's crazy. Except it's simple, okay? It's really not confusing. It's been the same since September 11th. Israel wants America to attack Iran. The Likud government of Israel, Sharon back then and Netanyahu now, they want, and hell, Ehud Olmert back in 2007, they want America to attack Iran. That's what it's all about to them. And I'm not saying that it wasn't all about Iraq, too. They were all about Iraq. I think part of the, one of the major reasons the neocons were for Iraq was just to get the bases there next door to Iran. So they could help figure out a way to get the one war to lead to the next war. At least have their, you know, so-called lily pad bases so they could threaten Iran from Iraq. And, so that's why what seems to you like a crazy policy on the face of it is insane. And there's no nuanced explanation that makes it not insane. It's as insane as it sounds on the face of it. To U.S. allies, Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria becomes the lesser evil. Al-Qaeda is the lesser evil. Are you ready, America? Bend over. Here we are with the rebranding of Al-Qaeda. Now they're the freedom fighters again, like during Ronald Reagan. Sorry for telling you that the reason we had to blow up the whole world was because of how bad these guys are. Actually, now they're working for us again. Actually, they have been for the last 4 years. Or is it we're working for them? It's crazy. It is. But it's simple. That's what Israel wants. That's the answer to it. And here, let me prove that real quick, because maybe that sounds inflammatory for people. But here is, for the unfamiliar. But here's Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And he's saying, he said this just right almost exactly a year ago, after the fall of it was the end of June. So it was a few weeks into the declaration of the caliphate, the massacre of hundreds of Shiite captives by the Islamic State as they came back from Syria into Iraq in a big way and conquered all of Anbar and or virtually all of Anbar and all of Mosul and up there in the northwest. And here is Michael Oren, and he's being very frank because he's at the Fancy Pants Aspen Institute, insiders only kind of meeting. There's a camera there. It's on YouTube. But he's speaking with Jeffrey Goldberg, Corporal Goldberg of the IDF, writer for The Atlantic, who helped lie you into war with Iraq from the pages of The New Yorker back in 2002 and 3 with a bunch of phony claims about Saddam and Osama. But anyway, so here's Michael Oren, and he's explaining to Jeffrey Goldberg.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
There you go. From Israel's perspective, let the Sunni evil prevail. And see, Israel wasn't attacked by Al-Qaeda on September 11th. America was. And so what's high treason, legal definition, high treason in Washington, D.C., is just a policy choice for Likud. But that's what makes it treason in D.C., is they do what Israel wants. Obama could just as easily, since 2011... said that, we're not going to support Mujahideen wars in Libya and in Syria. And if Lindsey Graham and the rest of them want to line up and tell us explicitly why it is that we should be backing Al-Qaeda in the Middle East, let them try it. But he hadn't done that. He's basically done a three-quarters McCain this whole time on the Libya and Syria issue. He hasn't been quite as bad as the neocon war party wanted him to be, but pretty damn bad this whole time. And it's also true that that's what Saudi and Turkey want too. It's not just because of Israel, but that's why the Americans are going along with it the way they're going along with it. As Obama himself explained to Jeffrey Goldberg in 2012, that yeah, this will help us take Iran down a peg by destroying Syria. It's right there. In fact, go to antiwar.com and look in the right-hand margin, and there's a great piece this week by Dan Sanchez. It's called The U.S. Government's Not-So-Secret Support for Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And he's just got great footnotes and great quotes going back for the last few years of summary there for you. It's really good. It's at antiwar.com. And, you know, I keep meaning to talk to Eric. That should be antiwar.com/Dan. Something real simple there. Anyway, right-hand margin there on antiwar.com, Dan Sanchez. All right, now, how much time I got? None. Well, it ends with this. The former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO gives the Wall Street Journal this quote. U.S. Navy Admiral James Stavridis. It is unlikely that we are going to operate side-by-side with cadres from Nusra, but if our allies are working with them, that is acceptable. If you look back to World War II, we had coalitions with people that we had extreme disagreements with, including Stalin's Russia, he said. So I don't think that is a showstopper for the U.S. in terms of engaging with that coalition. What? Okay, Stalin had, in fact, killed millions of people. And allying with him against Hitler was a hell of a thing. But here's the thing about Hitler. Hitler was Hitler. And Hitler declared war on the United States before the United States declared war on Germany in return. And Stalin had never attacked New York City and butchered 3,000 American civilians. So sorry for the Holodomor and all that kind of thing, but that wasn't an attack on the United States. This is our analogy. Because ISIS uses knives and Nusra does their massacres more often with bullets, which they do plenty of beheadings and suicide attacks too. ISIS are the ones who have renounced Al-Qaeda. This is worse than back in ISIS. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. We go now to our guest today, Rupert Stone, writing at newsweek.com, Beyond Torture, The New Science of Interrogating Terrorists. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm not bad, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here. Great piece of work here, especially for Newsweek. No offense to your editors who listen to this thing. Yeah, Beyond Torture, the New Science of Interrogating Terrorists. And, well, so first of all, I guess, could we start with there's going to be a new law. McCain and Feinstein in the Senate, at least, are pushing a new anti-torture bill. What's with that?
Okay, well, basically, this new bill is currently working its way through Congress. I think it's now due for a vote next week, probably. And it originated really with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's so-called torture report that came out in December last year. And that the kind of gruesome revelations of torture in that really prompted a whole new debate of the torture issue, and one of the recommendations that Senator Feinstein issued after that report came out was for there to be a new law which imposed firmer restrictions on the CIA interrogations, basically to stop them using these sorts of ferocious interrogation techniques. So that's really the context for the law. It will probably come to a vote next week, so we'll see what happens.
All right. Now, I think people in the audience might be wondering about the date here. We're halfway through 2015, talking about outlawing torture, when I think we all thought torture was already illegal. And that Bush was breaking the law when he authorized it in the first place. But then John McCain passed the Detainee Treatment Act in 2005, and he did compromise with Dick Cheney and make the CIA exempt from it. But he did restrict the military to the Army Field Manual in that thing, which Bush signed. And then when Barack Obama became president, he signed an executive order that said something about torture, didn't he? Why is it necessary, does John McCain think, to push a new law like this?
Okay, well, let me just I'll start with the executive order. I mean, the reason that they feel there's a need for congressional legislation in addition to that executive order is because, I mean, executive orders can be rescinded very easily in secret, I mean, basically by the stroke of a president's pen. So, you know, let's say you had a president who believed that there was a need to reinstate the CIA interrogation program, then he could just draw a line through that executive order, and it would certainly make it a lot easier to resuscitate those old methods. On the subject of wasn't torture always illegal, I mean, yes, basically. But, you know, what they've tried to do both with, initially with the Detainee Treatment Act and now with this is really close off the avenues by which creative lawyers could authorize torture, if you like, and could interpret the law so as to legitimize those sorts of torture tactics, if you see what I mean. But you're absolutely correct that, I mean, there are a bunch of prohibitions on the books against these sorts of brutal methods. I mean, the federal torture statute being one, which implements the UN Convention Against Torture, and then you've got the Geneva Conventions as well, and Common Article 3 of those, even if you don't think the other ones apply, prohibits degrading, inhumane treatment. So there is a lot of stuff. I do agree with you about that, certainly.
And I guess that really is the point about the Detainee Treatment Act, is Cheney frustrated McCain's efforts to apply that thing to the CIA back in 2005, and that's why he's doing this again 10 years later, is to include the CIA in it. Is that basically it?
That's exactly right. Yeah. The Detainee Treatment Act doesn't impose the Army Field Manual on the CIA, and that's exactly what this bill does. There are other orders and provisions in this bill to really, if you like, really seal the deal. One of them is it mandates the International Committee of the Red Cross have access to all detention facilities. So that's not just Department of Defense, which already needs to give the Red Cross access, but the CIA for any facilities it has, and even contractors, if they're running sort of strange, out-of-the-way places, they have to give the ICRC access. So it's actually, you know, by congressional standards, it's a very pretty solid bill, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And now, I'm sorry, because we are going...
There is one quite serious loophole in it, which is it doesn't say anything about CIA rendition or CIA black sites. But I mean, we can come on to that one later if you like. But that is worth discussing, I think.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So rendition and black sites. We'll certainly get back. I was going to ask, and I know I'm sorry, we're going a little bit off from the focus of the piece here, but does it have support in the House as well? It's obviously got bipartisan leadership for it in the Senate. Does it look like it's going to be a thing? I just haven't been able to keep up with that end of it at all.
What I've heard is that, yes, it does have bipartisan support, and it is expected to pass. And I think that's, you know, partly thanks to Senator McCain, mm-hmm. you know, who's a Republican and very senior and respected, and he's managed to get that crucial bipartisan support for it. So, yeah, I think it is expected to pass. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you never know.
Okay, now, so rendition and black sites, I mean, those are two different things. One is exporting people to be tortured somewhere else, or at least to be detained somewhere else. And it's extraordinary when they torture them, I guess, the way they put it. But then the black sites, we know, right, that they've had... they've claimed Somalian terrorists that they've when they kidnapped those guys, they held them on a ship at sea outside of the law for quite a while there. I forget all the particulars of that one. But then Cy Hirsch, in his new piece on the bin Laden raid, also had a throwaway line in there, which he refused to elaborate on this show, unfortunately, that, oh, yeah. And by the way, there's a black site still at Diego Garcia, which we've known there was one there from back in the Bush years. But so, yeah, in any case, that if we take his word for it, and I do, there is still a finding that is authorizing the CIA to do secret kidnappings and detainments, at least at Diego Garcia and who knows where else.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, I noticed that detail in the Hirsch piece. I mean, that's the first I'd heard of any kind of facility being on Diego Garcia now. And you know, actually, I wrote a thing about an interview with Lawrence Wilkerson earlier this year, which I don't know if you saw at Vice News, where he said that during the Bush years, he'd heard that the CIA did have a black site on Diego Garcia. So I absolutely agree. There are these reports that one did exist there. Just going back for a moment to the question of what the CIA can do now vis-a-vis detention and rendition, I mean, the executive order, Obama's executive order, one of the curious aspects is it still allows the CIA to detain prisoners, but it says on a, I think the wording is on a short-term transitory basis, that's it, which, you know, for some of us, life might seem short-term and transitory, so, you know, it's really a movable feast, whatever that means, but it does allow them to detain prisoners for however long, and it doesn't ban rendition at all. It doesn't impose any restrictions on extraordinary rendition. It did later, a kind of task force, which that order set up, did make recommendations about, you know, I think it's getting assurances from whichever country you're sending the prisoners to that they won't torture them and pull out their fingernails, etc. But you know, you can still do this stuff legally. At least there isn't a new restriction on it. And this legislation now, interestingly, other legislation now doesn't put any kind of restriction on those practices.
Yep. All right, I'm sorry. Hold it right there, Rupert. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody. Rupert Stone. He's writing at Newsweek, Beyond Torture. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Rupert Stone. He wrote this piece at Newsweek called Beyond Torture, The New Science of Interrogating Terrorists. So we're talking about the new McCain-Feinstein bill to re-outlaw torture and the loopholes in it. And now, also, you really get into some very interesting stuff in this article here. About the, a few more things here. First of all, Appendix M, and that is what binds the military's treatment, or supposedly in law, binds the military's treatment of their detainees. And then, of course, this whole report about how to get actual effective interrogations done, which is a whole other set of questions. But first of all, can you tell us about Appendix M and perhaps as it relates to Bagram Air Base or anywhere else where you know it might...
Okay, yeah, sure. So basically, the manual is, I mean, the whole reason it's played the role it has, central role in the Detainee Treatment Act and now this law, is because it basically, it does prohibit, most of the CIA interrogation techniques, the waterboarding, the sleep deprivation for days on end, et cetera, et cetera. But the interesting thing is that it has this special appendix, which was added onto it in 2006 when the document was revised, which authorizes what's called a special restricted interrogation technique called separation. And that might sound innocuous, but what that basically involves is 30-day putting a prisoner in isolation for 30 days or even more if a commanding officer gives his approval. It says you have to limit a prisoner no less than 4 hours sleep every 24 hours. Now, I don't know about you, but I mean, if I have one night of sleep where I have 4 hours, I feel quite bad the next day, especially 2 days, 4 hours sleep. Now, imagine if you're a prisoner who's just been captured, put in enemy captivity, and, you know, in a nasty prison cell with a nasty blanket being interrogated. And, you're restricted to that amount of sleep over an indefinite period, as the appendix allows. That is, I think, quite problematic and dangerous psychologically. So you have the potential for sleep deprivation there too, and sensory deprivation, because the appendix says if you can't separate a prisoner physically in a cell on his own, put him in him or her in solitary confinement, then you can apply goggles and muffs or blindfolds to that prisoner if he's outside and there aren't walls separating him from his environment from other people. That immediately conjures up images of Camp X-ray and the prisoners kneeling down there, the famous photo. And really doesn't have good ramifications. A prolonged isolation, sleep, sensory deprivation. I mean, the appendix doesn't rule out stress positions, neither does the manual, which is odd because they were explicitly banned in the previous version. So these aspects of the document are very problematic. And the bill actually contains a provision ordering a review of the manual to make sure its techniques are not only effective but legally compliant. So we might find in future that the appendix is shelved. I mean, certainly a lot of experienced interrogators and all sorts of human rights groups and even the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture have called for it to be removed. So we'll see what happens there.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean... That's the great segue into this report here, whether sleep deprivation is a good way to get the truth out of somebody. And especially, as you mentioned here, with goggles and earmuffs, that means blackout goggles and earmuffs, completely sound deadening earmuffs for sensory deprivation. And obviously combined with sleep deprivation, then you're talking about an attempt basically to drive them crazy, to break their mind. So how the hell are you supposed to get good intelligence out of somebody like that? But on the other hand, I mean, I guess it makes sense that they might say, okay, uncle, I'll become a good informant now or whatever, that kind of thing, because they can't stand it anymore, if that's the point, maybe. But seems just as likely you drive them crazy, you know, just as quickly as get them to comply. And then if you get them to comply, it seems like we're talking about two very different kinds of interrogations here. One is, tell me about Osama's friendship with Saddam Hussein and I'll stop torturing you because I need talking points to lie the people of my country into war. And then there's a second kind of interrogation, which is, hey, I really am trying to figure out what's going on here and get some real good intelligence out of you. And I think when you talk about the report here, the HIG report, the unquestioned premise is we want good intelligence rather than, you know, sometimes we want good intelligence. Sometimes we want to torture al-Libi until he says Saddam taught him how to make chemical weapons, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely what the sources in the story are saying, is the cooperation is very different from compliance. And, you know, if you coerce or abuse or torture a prisoner, you are just going to get the answers that you want to your questions. You're not necessarily going to get accurate information, where a prisoner who's cooperating is going to, if you like, voluntarily give up information he already has in a more reliable fashion. And, you know, Colonel Steve Kleiman, who was one of the main sources in the story, you know, I think we quote him as saying something like, you know, I don't want to force prisoners into telling me what they don't know. So it's, you know, it's a question of extracting knowledge and truth from prisoners, not forcing them to present lies that as you imply, might suit a political agenda in some cases, like going to war. I mean, the manual does contain several possible sort of, if you like, coercive or stress-inducing techniques, not just the appendix, but some forms of intimidation or mild humiliation. But on the other hand, on the plus side, it does contain some techniques that my story suggests are useful. So a basic ingredient that it recommends in any interrogation is rapport, building rapport. It says asking prisoners questions should be used, you know, just basic question and answer. Offering prisoners incentives like a cigarette or a cup of tea or something, you know, things like this to basically foster cooperation. And the manual does endorse some of those methods. So it's not all bad.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, those are the famous, I don't remember anymore what it's called, but there's some Sam Jackson movie from the 90s where he's the negotiator. And of course, everybody knows this is negotiator 101. The first thing that you do is make friends with the guy. Hey, look, man, it's you and me against the world. What can I do here to help make this thing work out for everybody? Whatever. That's obviously the stance that somebody takes. And then, and that's what works. And in the famous Al-Qaeda cases too, you mentioned the Zubeda case where, Ali Soufan, the FBI agent, was being nice to him and getting great intel until the CIA took him away for torture, and they didn't even ask him any questions for months after that. They just locked him in solitary. But then, you know, going back to the 90s, there was bin Laden's accountant, basically, in Sudan. They offered him medical treatment for his wife, and he said, screw Osama, here's all the paperwork I got. Blam, handed it right over. I mean, that's how you do this. Come on.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, especially if you're talking about, you know, Mujahideen guys, it's not like any of them are living a good life or whatever, right? You could find a way to give them a good incentive. And that's... Everybody knows that's what works. You don't even need a HIG study to tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these guys, some of them certainly in Afghanistan and Iraq, have lived, you know, in very rough societies where the levels of torture are, you know, absolutely eye-watering and really do, whatever you think about the CIA at its worst, I mean, really do surpass the CIA's enhanced interrogation program in terms of brutality. So, you know, they are hardened people, and they, you know, you are actually going to, you're going to have a more interesting impact on them if you treat them well, because they are used to rough treatment, and you can really have much more of an effective impact by being generous and non-confrontational with them, apparently.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, we don't want to get too bogged down in just the efficacy of it. I mean, it's an important point, but of course, if sometimes being nice to a guy ain't good enough, and you really think that maybe if you beat him, you could beat it out of him, sometimes you're just going to have to do without that information and tough, because what the hell are we, a bunch of barbarians, or is this Western civilization or not?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I think, I mean, you know, the story focused, I suppose, on the mainly on the practical side of it. But yeah, I mean, certainly, if you think of an analogy like enslavement or genocide, I mean, these are crimes, international crimes, on a par with torture. I mean, they're absolutely prohibited and can never be used under any circumstances. It says that explicitly in the UN Convention Against Torture. So would we commit genocide to acquire a military advantage? Would we enslave people for a commercial advantage? No one ever suggests that. So why on earth is torture even part of the public discourse? Is frankly, I mean, that's my view, certainly.
Yeah. Well, it is good that people are doing this kind of work and, you know, doing studies and showing, hey, here is what works. It's rapport building. And so, you know, we also know that I left out the one of the best ones was, I forget his real name now. His pseudonym was Matthew Alexander. And I interviewed him on the show, actually. And he was the guy who got the location on Zarqawi. And then they dropped a JDAM on Zarqawi's head and made him not Zarqawi anymore, which I think everybody agreed was a good idea to do. And even me, and I'm against all bombings, but bomb that guy? Okay, bomb him. But the way that Matthew Alexander got the information was that he made friends with the guy, and you know, unlike the rest of the military interrogators who were all trying to beat answers out of their captives, he was talking to this guy and tried to, you know, treat him with common decency, right? Not like he signed up for the other guy's movement or anything. Just treating him with decency and saying, hey, you know, tell me where we can find Zarqawi. And he gave him up.
Simply. Yeah, absolutely. He used actually one of the methods in the field manual to great effect, which is, I think, called emotional love, where he basically played on prisoners' love of their families to entice them into cooperating, and clearly did that to great effect. And I mean, as regards Zarqawi, I mean, he said that, you know, that rapport-based techniques were far more effective in producing intel that led to that guy. But also General McChrystal has been on the record saying that torture actually undermined and slowed down the search for Zarqawi. So, you know, it's a pretty mainstream view now that these methods are counterproductive from a practical perspective.
Yeah. Well, and actually, that's a lot coming from McChrystal, since he was in charge of Camp Nama there, where people were, in fact, tortured under his watch and under his control and jurisdiction at that time. So
that's a very good point. Yeah, I think people wonder if he's always held the view I just expressed. But
right, yeah, he learned that lesson firsthand, actually. He was the one doing the torturing, and it didn't work out. So we're glad that he learned one thing from that war.
Right.
It wasn't that the surge didn't work. He didn't learn that, but... Anyway, all right. Hey, listen, great journalism, and I really appreciate your time on the show, Rupert.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed that. Thanks a lot.
All right, y'all. That's Rupert Stone. He's written Beyond Torture, The New Science of Interrogating Terrorists. It's at Newsweek. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys, welcome back.
I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, of course, I went a little bit over time there into the break, like I always do, with Rupert Stone. Good stuff, man. Check out that article. It's like a couple thousand words. Got some very interesting things in it for you. We didn't even really get to talk about it. I'm sorry, it's my fault. I go on too long, dude. I know it, and I'm sorry, so who cares? But anyway, this report was suppressed. And he got himself a hold of it. That's the thing. He's got a real story here. And they figured out that, yeah, torturing people doesn't work unless you're trying to beat lies out of somebody. They didn't talk about that part. But they said, if you want the truth, then this is how you do it, and torture ain't the answer. So, for what that's worth, it was a Pentagon study. Okay? Okay. Sorry, I don't mean to be patronizing and insulting over such an important issue. I guess I just sort of assume everybody agrees already about torture, right? And if you don't, then I kind of hate you and don't care what stupid thing you think. You stupid pro-torturer, right? All right. Now, I'm getting back to Wall Street Journal and ISIS and whatever in a minute, but I got to talk about this for a second. I think it's interesting. I don't know exactly what to make of it. But Abe Foxman, who is the head of the Anti-Defamation League and, of course, likes to go around pointing his finger and calling everybody an anti-Semite, whether they actually are or not, he gave a talk at this thing, which is called the what? It was the Forum on Israel's Future at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Anyway, he's wearing a tuxedo in the picture or something, so... Oh, no, that's a file photo. Never mind. Oh, no. It says at the thing last week. At the ADL gala. Oh, that's different. Okay, it is a different picture. Anyway, but still. It was a Jewish group, a pro-Israel group that he was talking about. And he goes off and talks about his major resentment against Israel for taking American Jews and their support for granted, which, of course, like, say, for example, on the Iraq War, American Jews were better than any other ethnic group on that war and faster. They were against it. And right now, for example, I don't know about any other ethnic group as they divide them up, but certainly there was a poll there that's at Loblog right now, how American Jews support the Iran deal far more than the public at large. Better than 70%, where the public at large supports it in basically partisan terms of about 53 to 55%, something like that, support it. So, yeah, they support Israel, but they're not Likudniks. They're liberals. And they're not communists and, like, hardcore leftists almost entirely. They're, like, center-left Democrat types. And so they're just not Likudniks. And here Foxman is basically venting that. I don't know if he considers himself a Democrat or Republican. I always thought of him more as a conservative myself. But he's saying that Israel is taking American Jews' support for granted, and that they need to quit doing that. And they need to quit taking the United States of America for granted, because here they put themselves in a position where the state of Israel is dependent upon the United States, and then they do nothing but smack us. I was going to say back at us or something. You know, like we hand them stuff, and then they smack us in the mouth and say, thanks. Ungrateful bastards. And so anyway, Abe Foxman is going off about the government of Israel. And he's saying that they are threatening the very existence of the state, which I thought he thought was the priority. And then he even says, look, we don't have a magic formula, because only a magic formula would be possible here to work these things out. But if they ask me, I would say, he says, come up with some creative, dynamic approach for peace. It doesn't mean it will happen. But that's part of the existential disintegration of the support base. That's the quote from Foxman. So he's really upset about this. And, you know, the first tweet back I got on this when I put it out last night, someone said, and this is all at Mondo Weiss, by the way, you can read it. The first response I got back was, it sounds like kind of a limited hangout to me. Yeah, it's Abe Foxman. And in fact, he says right here, it doesn't mean it will happen. But for the government of Israel to just say, forget two states, we don't want peace, we're not going to negotiate, screw the Palestinians, we're taking their land slowly but surely, and there's not a damn thing anybody can do about it, and we're not pretending that to mean for there to ever be peace or equality here. For them to go that far is threatening American and American Jewish support for the state, and that was why he's panicking. Because how is Israel going to exist in its current form without foreign support, without U.S. support? And the answer is so simple. Just give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and let those people be free and have their own state. Maybe it's too late for that. And no, I'm not saying that's fair. I'm not saying I believe in that. I'm just saying from the point of view of the Israeli government, if they want to stay a super majority, super duper, 80-20 super majority Jewish state and a quote unquote democracy, well, geez, it was kind of a monkey wrench in the works there when half the population actually are Palestinian Arabs, Christians, and Muslims. So Foxman's got a point, and the point here is, you know, people, they attack Jimmy Carter. Oh my God, Jimmy Carter called Israel an apartheid state and said peace, not apartheid. Oh, what a terrible anti-Semite or something. But the way I look at that is, man, if you have provoked Jimmy Carter to use language like that, Jimmy Carter, and listen to the way he talks, like, oh, blah, 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 blah. He's a very conciliatory old person, you know what I mean? He's not poking and angry. He's not John McCain shouting, get off my lawn kind of thing. He's saying, I love you. I care about you. You're doing the wrong thing. Let me help advise you how to not destroy your own society. What the hell are you doing? It's got to be bad for Abe Foxman to be proverbially grabbing Netanyahu by the shirt collar and shaking the crap out of him and saying, what in the world are you doing to your future, you idiot? Is, I don't know. It's a signpost. It's a clue that there's something going on here, man. You know, to have Abe Foxman that upset. And to have it where, you know, still in Washington, D.C., it's complete and total 1,000% locked down political correctness that, oh yeah, no, whatever Israel thinks is best for Israel and America is what goes. Whether we're talking about Syria or whether we're talking about the so-called peace process or whatever it is, to think that they have to stay stuck on Netanyahu's track when even Abe Foxman is, turning around and sounding like Jewish voice for peace here, then, that's, I guess, the real tragedy, right? I don't know. Speaking of Mondo Weiss, I talked to you guys a couple weeks back about the American Netanyahu, Barack Obama's interview with, I don't think it was Goldberg again. Who was it that Obama did the interview with? It wasn't Tom Friedman again either. Was it? Maybe. Is Fitz in the chat room? Fitz would know. If any guys in the chat room can remind me, help me out. But anyway, Obama gave a real long interview where they had the excerpts at Mondo Weiss where he talked very frankly about, like, hey, what are you going to do? Are you going to be a democracy or are you going to be a super-duper Jewish state? And how are you going to continue to go on like you're going on now? And what the hell are you doing? Friends don't let friends drive drunk. I tried to take your keys. You won't let me. You got in. You drove off. Now what am I supposed to do for you, dude? Off you go. That's my words, not his, but that's basically Obama's point. Pretty honest words from a president. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I am so hungry for lunch. Jeez. Another 40 minutes of complaining. I can do it, man. I can do it. All right, hey, listen, I'm going to swear to you I'm getting back to U.S. support for Al-Qaeda. No, really, it's here in the Wall Street Journal. Still. In just a minute, but I gotta tell you, I have a regret from this past week of radio, which is the McCoy interview. A little bit across wavelengths there was all. I love Alfred McCoy. He's such a great writer and historian and great on very many important issues, the most important issues. And I think the article that he wrote for Tom Dispatch was just brilliant, and I hope everybody will look at it. And I think, yeah, part of it was just definitions and terms and maybe if we were, you know, had a little bit more time to hash it out, I think we would find that we agree about a lot. Maybe there was a disagreement. I mean, maybe it really does come down to, I mean, there didn't have to, certainly wasn't a problem, I don't think, between either of us. But I think, am I wrong, guys? Chat room dudes, help me out. It seemed like McCoy took the state's point of view for granted that, hey, world empire is power. The more powerful you are, the more powerful you are. And if somebody else gets more powerful, then you're losing power. And that kind of basic sort of take on things, where it seems to me that the more powerful you are, the more screwed you are. And in fact, this is the view not just of, you know, libertarian ideologues like myself, because he says, I think you're being ideological. And I don't know why, it totally failed me that I should have mentioned, well, look at Carol Quigley. Carol Quigley, who taught foreign policy at Georgetown and wrote The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope, and before that, The Evolution of Civilizations, which was a giant, I guess, Western civilization textbook for throughout America for decades. And he was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown. And he taught our friend John Utley of the American Conservative magazine. And if you read him carefully in Tragedy and Hope, what he's saying is, well, he says a lot of things in Tragedy and Hope, okay? But one of his major points, and this is his point of evolution of civilizations too, is that what civilizations do is they overdo it and then die. They create, or they attempt to create, world empires, and the whole thing is just murder-suicide writ large. That's all it is. Look what happened to the Soviet Union just in our lifetimes, or maybe you're a kid, but I was, you know, I don't know, how old was I, 13 or something. I was 13, 14 when the Soviet Union fell apart. Why? Ask John Mueller, University of Ohio. He was at University of Chicago. He says it's because after the Vietnam War, the American people got the Vietnam syndrome. They didn't want to screw around in all these foreign commitments anymore. They wanted retrenchment. They got rid of Nixon, and they brought in Ford. Well, they were stuck with Ford. But, you know, they wanted detente with the Soviet Union, and they wanted a rolling back of America's Cold War attempts to frustrate them all over the world. And what ended up happening was they expanded their commitments in South America, in Africa, in Afghanistan, and that was the final death knell. That was what finally broke the bank when they quit containing them. And, well, look at what's happening to America now. And this is something that's been at the heart of the contradiction of the American empire. Certainly in the 21st century, and I guess maybe all along. And I guess maybe he does have a point that all of America's military power and alliance system has helped to prop up the dollar as the international currency. That, you know, Kissinger had this negotiation with the Saudis to basically create oil standard, in a sense, where they would buy American debt with their excess cash and they would denominate all their oil purchases in dollars and all that. But the thing about that is that American dollars used to actually be worth a thing or two because the American economy was. And because compared to the rest of the world, war-torn, from World War II and then from all the transition from colonialism and all this going on, the American economy was the strongest in the world. So maybe U.S. dollars weren't as good as gold, but they're a hell of a lot better than rubles, right? I mean, what are you going to do? Put your currency reserves in gold or something sensical, or rubles or something, or the euro, something less sensical? So I don't think I necessarily agree with McCoy. I think his conclusion seemed to be that he thought that it was really the American empire that kind of forces the world to accept U.S. dollars the way they do. And I just don't think that would really work for this long in a row. And, you know, for all the talk of the collapse of that system coming due, I don't know how true it all is, but it seems like that's the deal. You know, if people demand a new kind of money to be the other half of all their transactions, they'll come up with one. You know, if the world's got to start using the Japanese yen, then I guess that's what they'll do. If they want to get the hell out of U.S. dollars, they will. Can't force them to stay. Well, I mean, you can try, but not effectively. It's just like a cartel, right? Somebody always cheats. Unless you can hire your congressman, bring him in on the conspiracy, and now it's called regulation. It's fine. But anyway, so I think Quigley is right. And you know what? I should finish my thought about Quigley there. Quigley's saying that empires die. Empires kill civilizations. When they embrace world empire, that's when they overdo it. And in fact, he says that the Western civilization, which he includes just Western Europe and America together, the Western civilization has been extraordinarily lucky that it has been able to reinvent itself numerous times. From, you know, ancient Greek civilization to Roman to the Holy Roman Empire, and then through the Renaissance and the Reformation and the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution and all these things, and still stayed, Western civilization in a sense this whole time, but that you can overdo it. And that world island is a pretty damn big island, man. You look at a map of that thing, you know, a position in Ukraine, a position in Afghanistan, that doesn't give you dominance over the world island. Look at the damn map of how huge Eurasia is. It's insane to think that the North Americans are the rulers of Eurasia, or could be, or that there's profit in that. And that in losing our position in Eurasia, that necessarily means we lose in the zero-sum game of economic life in the world. That's just crazy. The more trains between Madrid and Shanghai, the better. Period. The more trade, the more wealth created on Earth, the more capital saved and reinvested, the better for all of humanity. Get over your nationalism. There's no such thing as these borders anyway. All the empire ought to represent to you is a hand in your pocket, a gun to your head. And the only profit in it is for those who serve the empire itself, those who invest in Lockheed, in Citigroup. But then there's the rest of us.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I don't know, man. I got a lot of narrative, but I think I just want to stick to just proving it to you. Wall Street Journal. To U.S. allies, which is just cover for to U.S. and its allies. Give me a break. Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. That's Nusra. Anytime anybody says Nusra, they mean Al-Qaeda in Syria. Still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. To U.S. allies, Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria becomes the lesser evil. As Islamic State gains ground, calls to reach out to the Nusra front intensify. This is dated yesterday, actually. I thought it was today. Wall Street Journal. And by the way, if you put it in Google News, you can get there from there without the paywall. In the three-way war, ravaging Syria, should the local Al-Qaeda branch be seen as the lesser evil to be wooed rather than bombed? This is a serious question. It's posed as a serious question. That it's even a question. Because, of course, the answer is yes, if that's what Israel wants. Okay, sorry. This is increasingly the view of some of America's regional allies and even some Western officials. In a war now in its fifth year, in which 230,000 people have been killed and another 7.6 million uprooted, few good options remain for how to tackle the crisis. Yeah, never mind how we got into it. Never mind the history leading up to this. The three main forces left on the ground today are the Assad regime, Islamic State, and an Islamic rebel alliance in which the Nusra... Nice little play on Star Wars there. In which the Nusra Front, an Al-Qaeda affiliate, designated a terrorist group by the U.S. and the U.N., plays a major role. Outnumbered and outgunned, the more secular, Western-backed rebels have found themselves fighting shoulder to shoulder with Nusra in key battlefields. As the Assad regime wobbles and Islamic State, or ISIS, gains ground in both Syria and Iraq, reaching out to the more pragmatic Nusra is the only rational choice left for the international community, supporters of this approach argue with a straight face. The dilemma in Syria facing policymakers is heightened by continued reports of atrocities committed by Nusra, including the killing of prisoners and the alleged execution on Wednesday of more than 20 Druze villagers by a local commander following an altercation over a house. It does say something when suddenly Nusra becomes a lot more tempting. It speaks volumes as to the severity of the situation, said Saudi Prince Faisal bin Saud bin Abdul Motion, a scholar at the King Faisal Center for Research and Islamic Studies in Riyadh. At this point, we must really differentiate between fanaticism and outright monstrosity. At first, this is a real thing, man. I'm not reading something out of The Onion or some, like, you know, the Duffel blog or some satire. This is a thing in the Wall Street Journal, everybody. This is a thing in the journal. And I know you're not surprised, but you better be shocked. And I know that this exact thing has been going on for 4 years. I've been covering it day in and day out this entire time. Check the archives. But still. I got to make sure that in case new people are tuning in, that they're not going, come on, what is this nonsense, conspiracy crap, unbelievable assertions out of this loudmouth's mouth. Oh, I'm just reading the Wall Street Journal to you here, that's all. Yeah, Al-Qaeda, they're not that bad. You've got to differentiate between fanaticism and outright monstrosity. Never mind that Nusra and ISIS are de facto allies. They do fight each other, sort of, but mostly they fight the Assad government. Mostly they're enemies of the Assad government. There are two different parts of one rebellion. So, differentiate that. At first, reads the Wall Street Journal from yesterday, It was mostly Turkey and Qatar that aided Syrian Islamist rebels cooperating with Nusra. Regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia was more reluctant, wary of abetting al-Qaeda, an avowed enemy of the House of Saud. In recent months, however, Saudi Arabia's new King Salman has moved to work much more closely with Doha, that's Qatar, and Ankara, that's the Turks, in supporting the Islamist-dominated rebel alliance that includes Nusra, diplomats and officials in the region say. These countries see the suffering inflicted on Syria by the Assad regime as the main reason for the Islamic State's emergence in the first place. And they prefer to see Nusra and its allies, rather than Islamic State, move into territory surrendered by Damascus. Those are your choices. They define the terms, they get to choose. The Turks, the Saudis, and the Qataris have decided that the problem above all is to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, and the Americans don't have leverage over them to change what they are doing, said Robert Ford, who served as U.S. ambassador to Syria in 2010 through 14 and is now a quote-unquote scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. And, of course, he supported the rebellion all along when he was in power there. And from the very beginning, he encouraged the uprisings and encouraged violent uprisings. Those countries are willing to use even the extremist groups. Oh, this is a quote of Ford now. Those countries, all of our allies, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, are willing to use even the extremist groups like Nusra to bring down Assad. And that determination came out of the failure of the United States to provide a viable alternative to those extremists by ramping up substantially support for more moderate groups, Ford said. What a bunch of crap. That's going to be the Hillary Clinton and every single Republican line in the coming campaign. And only Rand Paul could get it right if he's willing to get it right and fight them on it. And have a great time making ridiculous fools out of them. He could. Because as Obama himself has admitted, and again I refer you to the Dan Sanchez piece at antiwar.com, he has great quotes from Obama, not just the Ben Swan quote that I play where Ben Swan, well, here's the Swan Obama. But Dan Sanchez has even better ones where Obama is acknowledging back in 2012 the danger of the Islamists and the rebellion, and his reluctance to back the rest of the rebellion. And, of course, you hear the Hillary clip at the top of this show every day about backing al-Qaeda.
I share that concern, and so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
So there's him admitting to the great and courageous Ben Swan, who put it right to him. You're attacking al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Yemen, but you're backing the rebellion that includes al-Qaeda in Syria. How do you square that, Mr. President? Blam, Ben Swan. Damn, dude. Get him. I think that makes him the best, presidential question asker of this entire era. Has any other reporter asked him a question that good on a subject that touchy this whole time? Anyway, so there he is. And he also correctly told Thomas Friedman, come on, the idea we're going to build up an army of moderates to check ISIS, Nusra, and Assad, and Hezbollah, the latter two backed by Iran, was always a fantasy that could never have happened. Backing the rebellion, as Hillary implies in the clip, was backing al-Qaeda, always has been. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm sorry, I got to get this out of the way real quick. Headline at McClatchy, D.C. That's all you need to know is the headline. Story doesn't matter. Bernie Sanders, that is, surprised by the large crowds at his campaign events. Well, it ain't because of him. Well, it is somewhat because of him. He seems like he just says what he means. Well, be careful, because some of the things he says are pretty stupid and sometimes even horrible and evil, like how much he supported Israel in their war against the civilians of the Gaza Strip last year. He can be really bad on some things, but I guess he is, you know, pretty forthright. But what's really going on here is Democratic voters are desperate for somebody other than Hillary Clinton. She is already done. People just don't like her, dude. She's not a very likable person. Well, she's likable enough, Obama said. And he could have said, no, I think she's great. But he just couldn't bring himself to say it. He just, you know, I don't know, man. And, you know, her last book sold like 1/100th of what the one before that sold. Right? They had this whole giant book tour scheduled. We're talking a year ago. Long before, you know, the announcing of the campaign or whatever. And the thing was a complete flop. Like, almost on the level of Rick Santorum and one person coming out to see him talk. It was really bad, so they basically just, they scaled it way, way back, and then they canceled the rest. There's a story the other day about how, oh, she's not restarting her campaign. She's just starting again or something. They want to make a clean break and just completely restart the announcing of her campaign because what a disaster that was. Well, why? Because we don't like your Scooby-Doo van? Because if only you had used a different kind of van or something, then it would have been great. The thing is, she's evil. And she's in it solely for herself. And everyone can tell. And so they want someone else. Not much redeeming about Bernie Sanders, dude. Not really. But at least he ain't Hillary. That's why people are coming out to see him. They're trying to see, huh, I wonder if this guy could be a viable alternative. Because they just don't want her. And really, the only news there is, that makes me happy, that makes her sad. Because she certainly understands that. I think, at this point, I think it's still a pretty sure thing she'll get the nomination, because who can stop her? But then again, it's still a long way away. Still a year from the coronation, so she could blow it. But, anyway, I just think it's interesting. I just think it's kind of fun to watch her squirm, really, is all. It's just entertainment for me, because I hate Hillary Clinton's sorry, stinking, murderous, lying guts. Lying murderer with stinky guts that she is. Okay, now back to important news. So, yeah, there's this thing on the Islamic State. I got to mention this, too, before I get back to the Wall Street Journal. I'm getting back to the Wall Street Journal in a sec. But there's this German journalist who, his name is Jürgen Todenhofer. And he went and hung out with the Islamic State in Mosul and Raqqa for a few weeks and made it back alive. He negotiated a safe passage over months over the internet with these guys, and they decided they would not murder him. They would let him come in and do some reporting. So he came in and he did some reporting, and basically what he had to say was, yeah, man, they are genocidal lunatics, and if they get their way, they'll kill every last Shia in the world. And they're perfectly happy to say so, and they're basically Nazis in their enthusiasm for the project, too. They're pretty damned bad, the Islamic State guys. And secondly, yep, they rule an area the size of Great Britain, and they've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new recruits every day. They come flooding in. Give them something to believe in. Something they can fight for, not have to wait till they're dead to enjoy. And something that stands in stark contrast to the self-serving and corrupt and foreign bribed and supported dictatorships of the region, too. These guys are bastards, but they're local. Al-Baghdadi, that means he's from Baghdad, even though he's really not, but that means from around here. Not backed by the Americans, like the House of Saud. And anyway, so just like with the 9/11 hijackers, none of them were from Iran, Iraq, Syria. They were all from countries that America supports the dictatorships of their countries, and that's why they did it. They were all from allied states. So now that George Bush has carved out this lawless jihadistan in western and northwestern Iraq, and now that Barack Obama has carved out this gigantic jihadistan in eastern Syria, and it's declared itself the caliphate, and they have declared themselves the caliphate, they're just growing in strength. Now, it's true they're landlocked, and they don't have any official commercial relations with outsiders, but, you know, reading Coburn recently, there's food in the stores, man. They're getting by. They're doing okay. They are creating a pretty damn powerful state, and one that can hardly be defeated by any regional power, certainly not by the Iraqi government, the so-called Iraqi government, the government of Shiistan, from Baghdad to Kuwait, down there. They don't have the power. Maybe Iran with a full-scale invasion. Maybe Turkey with a full-scale invasion could rouse these guys out, but only for a short time, and then what? Who are they going to put in power then? Which Sunni warlord is going to come in but be moderate enough to earn himself legitimacy and power and enough to keep the Islamic State at bay without foreign support? And the Turks don't want to do it. The Turks love them. And the Iranians don't want to do it, I don't think, because they know they'll lose a lot of guys and it'll be a hell of a fight, and they'll be fighting, you know, far past friendly territory to try to take Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi would be a huge task for the Iranians, and they would simply be sowing seeds of further conflict and destabilization and destruction as they go. Look at, got a story about Tikrit right now. It's a ghost town looted to the nth degree by the Shiite militias. This is in the Times, the London Times. Shooting Shia, looting Shiite militias transformed Tikrit into a city of ghosts, they write. And so wherever they go, they're just driving more Sunnis into the arms of the Islamic State. And it's a hell of a problem. But I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that the only solution is for America to abolish the army and the CIA and never intervene anywhere else in the world ever again. Isn't that the obvious conclusion here? What are we supposed to do? Support the Iranians more? Support the Bada Brigade and their power drill, torture to death tactics? And further sectarian cleansing of Sunnis, as has been our policy in Eastern Islamic State, a.k.a. former Western Iraq. Or we should keep backing Al-Qaeda, like it says in the Wall Street Journal here. They ain't so bad compared to ISIS. So let's, and even though they're de facto allies with ISIS, and even though they're basically a different name, They're the exact same ideology. And remember, ISIS still claims Bin Laden's corpse, the spirit of Bin Laden's rebellion. They just don't like Zawahiri, and they don't like doing what Zawahiri says. But they still say, you know, hey, look at us. We've created the caliphate just like Osama bin Laden always wanted us to do, and that kind of thing. Trying to inherit that same legacy. After all, what is really Nusra is the break off from Al Qaeda in Iraq, right? They're just the more Syrian dominated faction of Al Qaeda in Iraq. And ISIS is Al Qaeda in Iraq. Just grown up and dominated not by Jordanians or Qawi, but by Iraqis from Samarra mostly. So if anything, you know, ISIS is just as Al-Qaeda is, as Al-Qaeda is. Oops, I had an extra is in there. You know what I was trying to say. So, not only are they more violent, just barely, they're still our declared enemies. And then, if the leader of Syrian Al-Qaeda says, nah, I don't mean to attack the West, and don't worry, Zarqawi doesn't want me to attack the West, and I'm not going to attack the West because Zarqawi has told me not to. Doesn't that say to you that, yeah, he will attack the West when it suits his needs and when Zawahiri tells him to do it? This is supposed to be the moderate force. The ones who are loyal not just to dead bin Laden, but living Zawahiri. And I ran out of time. Man, you got to go look at this thing. Just put this headline in Google News and you can get around the paywall. To U.S. allies, Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria becomes the lesser evil. They're talking about the U.S. too. No mistaking it. You can find Jason Ditz's write-up of it at antiwar.com today as well.